Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, October 7th, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our Courthouse Steps edition of telephone, the topic is Holt v. Hobbs, the case argued earlier today in the U.S. Supreme Court. It concerns the length of a beard of a prisoner. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Very pleased to welcome to today's call Mr. Jordan Lawrence. He attended oral argument this morning and is going to give us his views on what transpired today. Jordan Lawrence is Senior Counsel and Senior Vice President in the Office of Strategic Initiatives at the Alliance Defending Freedom. And with that, Mr. Lawrence, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I did go up to the Supreme Court today to watch this case. It's called Holt v. Hobbs, and is one of the first cases where the Supreme Court had to deal with the RLUIPA statute, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. And this is basically what happened in the case. The prisoner, Holt, is a convert to Islam. And Islam requires people to, men to grow beards. The prison in Arkansas, where he is, prohibits beards except for quarter-inch beards for men that have skin conditions requiring them to grow out their hair so they don't become, for example, ingrown if they shave the normal way. The Eighth Circuit affirmed the rule, and the prisoner had a handwritten cert petition, kind of like Gideon v. Wainwright. You know, most of the time these prisoner petitions are routinely turned down, but this guy was, the one in a thousand or whatever the odds are that got granted review. And after that happened, somehow, and I'm not even quite sure how this happened, Doug Laycock, now law professor at the University of Virginia, was brought in to represent the prisoner. This was his fifth time that he's argued at the Supreme Court, so he has some familiarity with the process that was going on there. Just some highlights of the oral argument, and maybe some big picture thing that I would say here is that the state of Arkansas justifies this policy based on the fact that it has security concerns that express themselves two ways: that you can hide contraband in a beard, and that it would be easy for an escaped prisoner to alter his appearance by growing a beard, escaping, and then shaving his beard. You know, kind of like how Harrison Ford did in the movie The Fugitive, if you remember that, and I'm sure the prisoners pay attention to those kinds of things. One fun fact about the oral argument is that the attorney from the Attorney General's Office of Arkansas was a student of Doug Laycock's when Laycock taught at the University of Texas. So there was sort of this, Obi-Wan Kenobi battling the Darth Vader kind of a thing from the first Star Wars movie. But it wasn't quite that dramatic, but it was still kind of an interesting thing I found out. Here are some my highlights of the oral arguments. I think that the court is going to rule in favor of the prisoner, and they seemed almost to think that this was an easy case, but what they're concerned about are the cases that are to come. They're definitely concerned about how a requirement imposed by this federal statute requiring that any imposition on a sincere religious belief, the government must justify with a compelling state interest done in the least restrictive means. Well, how do you reconcile that or mesh that with prison situations where they have their significant security concerns? This, to me, was a really big question that the justices seemed to wrestle with. They seemed to latch on in this case that the fact that the prison said there was a policy that said that prisoners could grow beards for medical reasons, but they couldn't grow them for religious reasons. So it was almost like, okay, we're going to, rule in favor of the prisoner, with your concerns about them shaving their beards like Harrison Ford did in The Fugitive. Well, then take a picture of the prisoners when they're clean shaven and after they have the beard. You know, you can't hide much in a half inch beard. That's not very long at all. And you know, so the contraband hiding just really isn't that serious. Now, there was some question that Justice Scalia, and this was sort of an interesting thing, was this the right case? He brought up the fact that Islam generally teaches that people, men are supposed to grow full beards, not half-inch beards. And that, so this, if this was his religious belief, Scalia said something like that, you know, that the religious beliefs are based on a principle, and you don't negotiate your principles. So this really bothered him, that maybe, you know, that this guy should be arguing for a full beard, which comes out in many cases, and that maybe this was improvidently granted, and that they should dig the case, deny the petition as improvidently granted. Now, one of the other things is that sometimes in these oral arguments, you will get they were looking for the case that was beyond this. What about full beards? What about really long hair? And then I think even beyond that, you know, what about sweat lodges? What about, you know, just all sorts of things? Justice Ginsburg brought up that there was a whole series of cases before RLUIPA statute was passed, I believe it was in the year 2000, that upheld practices that are these now going to have to be relitigated. So, for example, there would be prisons that banned racist literature that would foment race-based conflict in the prisons. And the Supreme Court said that was okay because of the security concerns. Well, would that have to all be relitigated under RLUIPA? And Doug Laycock basically said, yes, it was. So I think that they're almost looking beyond for the next case with all of this. And again, like I said, it was almost as if they were somewhat bored almost with the specific case that was before them. We also had this situation that will sometimes happen where one of the attorneys will say something that seems like a surprise. Now, I've argued at the Supreme Court. I've seen and helped many other people with their cases before the Supreme Court. And it's always interesting to me how you'll have these cases where they've been litigated through like three levels of courts. They've been in the court system 5 or 10 years. And then somebody says something for the first time that this is makes a factual assertion that people say, wait, that's not in the record, or that's not true. Oh, yes, it is in the record. And they get this kind of factual dispute that kind of arises for the first time. And there were a couple of those that came up at this at the hearing today. One of them was, does the medical beard exception actually exist or not? And Doug Laycock says there is a policy that says you can have a quarter-inch beard. And Arkansas, the attorney for Arkansas, disputed that, saying that there wasn't such a policy. But then when he was pressed, he said, well, the policy, yeah, it does say a quarter inch, but really how it works out in real life is that these prisoners go and get shaved with barber clippers every couple of days. So they have this sort of, you know, 3-day, you know, growth, you know, like, I don't know, like Yasser Arafat or something like that. And that it's really not an official policy. Well, that to me just sort of throws this sort of weird factual dispute kind of smoke grenade into a case. And I'm just not sure that this is really going to help the state of Arkansas very much that they brought this up. The other thing that seemed to get a little more traction was this fact that the way that Arkansas runs its prison system that they kept saying is different than other prisons, and that they put them in barracks and have them march outside each day to work outside the confines of the prison, which brought these issues of contraband smuggling in the beards and changing their identity by, you know, escaping and then shaving their beards were much more significant. And this seemed to take everybody off, like everybody, the justices seemed to be surprised. What, they're in barracks, they're not in actual cells, and they go outside most every day? Yeah, they, you know, outside the prison walls. And And I think that's another factual dispute that's going to have to be cleared up as to what that means. Now, of course, and I'll just wrap this up with here, there was humor that came forth. And so I took notes of these so I could share these to end with. These are two of the more funnier moments that happened at the oral argument. Justice Kagan was playing the straight man here with, and Scalia got the zinger line. And Kagan was asking the lawyer for the state of Arkansas, whether there's some sort of balance. This might have been the Solicitor General too. That I'm trying to remember now. It was one or the other. The SG's office came in favor of the prisoner in this case. But Justice Kagan was asking, is there a point where accommodating a prisoner's religious beliefs is so expensive that becomes a compelling state interest, that the expense? And the SG basically said, yes, it would at some point, or it was the attorney for Arkansas, and I just don't remember right now. Scalia then interrupted and said, this is a compelling state interest. The government could raise taxes if it's too expensive and deal with it that way. And there was, of course, laughter in the audience. The other thing was, they were talking about, you know, if you have a half-inch beard, which isn't very long, what could you smuggle in there? And Alito talked about hiding a SIM card or a revolver in your half-inch beard. And that, again, evoked laughter from the audience. I think we're probably going to see a 9-0 decision in this, maybe with some concurrences. But I think what was really going on here was people struggling with how to enforce this statute that has a pretty strong protection for prisoners in their high secured environment of a state prison.
Well, thank you very much. We certainly appreciate it. Let's turn to the audience for questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for Jordan Lawrence, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert today, Jordan Lawrence, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one caller question at this point. Before we go to that first caller, let me make a just quick announcement about our upcoming schedule of calls. We've got calls on each of the remaining days of the week. Tomorrow, Wednesday at noon, our topic for Teleforum will be why government fails so often and how it can do better. Then Thursday at 2 p.m., we'll be talking with FTC Commissioner Maureen Olhausen. And then Friday at 1 p.m., we'll be discussing the Take Care Clause and the President's duty to defend acts of Congress. Those are all Eastern times. And all that information is also available on the Federalist Society's website. Today, of course, we're talking to Jordan Lawrence about the Hobbs, and we're in the Q&A period. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, my name is Heather Rice Minus. I'm with Justice Fellowship, the advocacy arm of Prison Fellowship Ministries, and got to attend the oral argument today. And I'm wondering what your take is on the question of deference and the standard. Do you think that the Supreme Court will punt on that, or will try and flesh out what that standard should be going forward?
This is a great question, and I would say the bulk of the oral arguments focused on this is that how much deference should a court grant to the government's claim of a security interest in a rule that burdens religious liberty. And let me just, I just want to, before I, let me just, so to flesh this out a little bit more. I do a lot of religious liberty litigation, and I would say that it is very uncommon to have this kind of huge issue of security kind of weighing in the entire context. Now, what RLUIPA says, and even before RLUIPA, when the pre-RLUIPA cases that the Supreme Court has had in lower courts, just because there's security concerns doesn't mean that the government always wins, that any rule that it has is justified, that sort of thing. But there was some level of deference that the courts would grant to prisons so that they weren't second guessing their security concerns, and then, you know, there would be a prison riot or somebody was killed or something like that because they were forced, prison officials were forced to accommodate somebody's religious beliefs. The other thing, although, you know, Congress heard this testimony, is that there's sort of an unfortunate fact that prisoners at times, if I had to say, what's the group that brings the most ridiculous and far-fetched religious liberty claims, it would have to be, without a doubt, in my opinion, prisoners. Some of them are serious. Some of them have been far-fetched, where whether the religious beliefs are actually sincere becomes a real issue. That there was a case a number of years ago, where a guy said, my religion requires, you know, expensive wine and filet mignon be served to me as a sacrament every night. You know, that type of thing. And so this can be kind of a concern. But most of this debate was about then, okay, how much does the government defer to the security claims and interests stated by the state officials, and how much do they independently do them? And there was a lot of tests that were being proposed, and we should interpret it this way, and, you know, the fact that deference isn't really written into this. And basically what – and I'm looking at my notes right here – that he basically said – and I'm still searching for this here, but I think that it has to be like a serious concern, that it's got to be a genuine and a serious security concern. Because not only said that the government, I'm sorry, the prisoners can bring frivolous claims, the government can also, their sin is to sin on the side of uniformity. We just want, you know, this is just too much hassle to deal with exemptions from these general rules. So we're just going to say that every one of our rules that requires uniform treatment is compelling and has a security cause and that sort of thing. So how do you reconcile deference to a compelling state interest standard is not the easiest thing in the whole world, but it is the statutory requirement. And basically, it's whether the government's interest is substantial, is genuine, that they can show actual examples of it being violated. These are some of the things that Doug Laycock was bringing. He also had brought up as to whether other prison systems have similar rules. And he pointed out, now I kept hearing different numbers throughout the oral arguments, but it's at least 40 state prison systems allow prisoners to have beards that are at least a half inch long. So this is basically not a compelling governmental interest, at least when you start talking about other state prison systems. Then the argument came out, well, why is that relevant? And the Arkansas attorney made the argument that because they have more of this barracks-oriented prison setup rather than a cell block type of prison system, that these concerns about smuggling contraband and the fact that they go outside the walls a lot, the fact that their concerns about smuggling contraband and shaving to alter their appearance are greater concerns than if you had a cell block form of prisons. This is going to be the big question. I think the courts are going to be wrestling with this. How much deference do you grant when a security interest is asserted as the main governmental interest?
Mr. Lorden, this is Dean. You mentioned during your remarks there genuine concerns on the part of the state. Was there any discussion today about whether or not the prisoners' beliefs were genuinely held, firmly held religious beliefs, or is that already established in the record or stipulated to?
In this particular case, the sincerity of the religious beliefs was not contested. And that this man has seemed to have a genuine conversion to Islam, and it is a pretty common understanding of Islam for men to grow beards. The sincerity issue has come up in other cases, and it is a component of the RLUIPA test. I would say, like, if you're – I mean, just to compare and contrast – the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which we had the Hobby Lobby Conestoga cases earlier this spring. And the organization I work for, Alliance Defending Freedom, had one of those cases, and the Beckett Fund had the other case. Sincerity of religious beliefs rarely comes up. I mean, you might have something like if somebody says, you know, I've converted to the, you know, my name is Bob, I've converted to the Church of Bob, I've donated all my money to the Church of Bob, therefore I don't owe any, have any income to report to the IRS. That would raise some sincerity issues. But they're very extreme, very rare. The prison cases, I think they're more common. And you also get more exotic types of religions, you know, requiring, you know, I need a knife for my religious practice, or I need a sweat lodge, things like that, that bring up unique concerns in a security context. And so therefore, sincerity, is this really a sincere religious belief or some pretext for some other thing that's going on? But then on the same hand, I would, is that the government's interest, they just tend towards uniformity, so they don't want to accommodate anybody, basically, if they had their way about it.
We're speaking with Jordan Lawrence. If you have a question, we have one question pending at this point, and our lines will be open. You need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Jordan, thanks so much for attending the argument and telling us about it. Dean, this is Lee O'Connor, by the way. Dean asked one of my questions, and that was whether the sincerity of this prisoner's beliefs had been tested, and thank you for answering that. And in the process of answering it, you touched on the other question I was going to ask. When you told us about humor, I expected you to give us the parade of horribles that you can, that one can envision when one applies the slippery slope argument. Well, if we let him have a half-inch beard, then the next guy's going to want to do all sorts of other things. Was that not part of the argument today?
There was some slippery slope stuff about, you know, are we going, but it was more along the lines of, you know, are we going to compromise at a 3/4-inch beard? I think the Chief Justice said that, and it was like, you know, this gets to be ridiculous. But they did not go expand this into, you know, sweat lodges, et cetera, et cetera. And what I think is interesting is that, and Eugene Volokh has written about this, you know, the legitimacy of the slippery slope argument. And slippery slope is kind of a, you know, you can disparage it like, oh, you know, that the you know, you're bringing up an argument that's a slippery slope argument. You know, somehow the buzzer sounds, you lose because you raise the slippery slope argument. But I do think that there is a, and the court is rightly concerned about this, is that asserting a principle that has ramifications beyond the facts of the case before it, and that a court wisely, and I think in a responsible way, asks questions about, well, if we make this principle in this case, how, what are the ramifications of this? How far does this go out? What are the limiting principles of that? And that's essentially a slippery slope argument. And, you know, to inject a divisive question in here, it seems like this case, they're very concerned about the ramifications of it. In same-sex marriage, it seems like you know, you're just being an alarmist if you bring up any concerns about what the ramifications of the case are. And I think the better argument is that every principle has ramifications that goes beyond the very facts of the case before it, and how far is that? And I think that that's a legitimate concern for parties to raise in court and for courts to consider.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We still have just one caller question pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, hi. This is Bill Otis. I'm a part-time law professor at Georgetown, and I worked for a number of years as a federal prosecutor. And I wanted to ask about Arkansas's assertion that uniformity is needed. And I was wondering in particular whether Arkansas made the argument that uniformity is a legitimate and indeed compelling state interest in the context of prisoners specifically, not just for reasons of security, but for reasons of rehabilitation. Rehabilitation over the long haul is a failure. There was a recent Department of Justice study that showed that a little more than three-quarters of prisoners on release go back to crime. So rehabilitation, as we've been doing it, hasn't worked. In my view, having worked as a prosecutor for some time, part of that is because of prisons' refusal or inability to understand what it is they're actually dealing with. It's not just security concerns. It's the fact that people wind up in prison because they think that rules are for suckers. They make their own rules, and if you don't go along with that, that's your problem. That is a way of thinking that needs to be changed, and it seems to me that uniformity, simply for the sake of uniformity, in other words, to change the way that the prisoner regards what it is to be socialized and what it is to need to follow rules, whether or not you agree with them, is a legitimate goal of incarceration, one that has not been being well served. I was wondering whether Arkansas made that component of the argument. And then the only other thing I would say is that I certainly agree with our experts' belief that many of these prisoner suits, indeed in my experience, all of them, are essentially phony. In all the years that I worked for the Department of Justice, I never experienced a prisoner who had converted, for example, to become a Methodist or a Presbyterian, not a single one. It's always Islam, or it's some personal religion that of the kind that our expert was talking about, or it's a Wiccan, or something you just never see, or almost never see, outside the prison context. But what we need to understand is the prisoners have a lot of time on their hands, no expenses to bear, and nothing to lose by trying in filing these suits. And I wonder as well whether the state of Arkansas made that point in its argument today, and if so, whether they made any hay in it. Thank you for taking the question.
Professor Otis, with your experience as a prosecutor, understand this at a deeper level than I think got argued today. I'm trying to remember in their briefs if the state of Arkansas or any of the amici brought this up, and I just don't remember it, although I could have missed that when it happened. I can tell you it did not come up in the context of the oral arguments today, that this was all about security concerns and not you're talking about like a deeper issue of basically re-socializing prisoners. Is that possible? They just have to obey rules and not basically be, you know, trying to figure out some angle to get around them and that sort of thing. And this issue has not come, it did not come up in the oral arguments, but the issue of lack of sincerity of these religious beliefs has been voiced in other contexts about these prisoner religious liberties cases.
Thank you very much.
We do have another question. Let's go to our next caller. Phone?
Hi, this is Andrew Brasher. I work for the state of Alabama and happen to have filed an amicus brief in support of Arkansas in this case. I think I might have been the only one to have filed an amicus brief in support of Arkansas in this case. We have a very similar policy with our prison system. I did make a little bit of the uniformity argument in that brief, but I did want to just comment that I think that Justice Scalia's question and argument about why this case is whether the court should just dig this case is a really good question, because if you look at the record of the case, you can kind of see that Arkansas got a little bit tricked here in the sense that they treated this case like your typical pro se prisoner case. You don't actually have to hire an expert. You know, this is basically frivolous litigation. They put up folks as witnesses who didn't really know much about what they were talking about. And then when this guy managed to hire Doug Laycock to take his case, it ended up that he could make very strong arguments that were not addressed in the district court below or in the Eighth Circuit. And I kind of wonder whether any of that came out a little bit during the argument besides, I guess, Justice Scalia's question about whether the case should just be dismissed as improvidently granted.
And, Andrew, you had a lot of states that joined your brief, so it just wasn't little old Alabama.
It was a formidable bipartisan group of states that that weighed in for the issue as opposed to just addressing this one particular policy.
Well, let me say that there was not a the way that this came up, and I, you know, I read through the briefs and all of this, but this is not an area of law that I study. But it was, but I am a student of the Supreme Court. I was struck at it's hard for me to remember if I've ever heard in oral arguments a justice raising the question of whether they should dig the case, dismiss it as improvidently granted. That is, I mean, that kind of startled me. And it's, so it said to me that there is something in this case that they, you know, that is causing them pause. Now, what Justice Scalia said, what you're giving is kind of more of a plausible kind of big picture thing of what might be going on in the case, which I didn't pick up from the briefs. My radar was not attuned to that. What he said was that how weird it was to say, Islam requires me to have a full beard. Oh, you won't give that to me? What about a half-inch beard? My religious beliefs are kind of flexible. And this was very much bothering Justice Scalia. And it was more like the lack of sincerity, although Justice Scalia did not utter that phrase, but he felt like that we, you know, let's get a full beard case where it's treated more seriously, that sort of thing. That he kept referring back to, and I'm looking at my notes here, about how that religious beliefs are based on something that's, you know, enduring and unchangeable. Those weren't his words, and I'm trying to find them right now. But that to negotiate what an acceptable accommodation would be just seemed kind of weird to him. And the argument that Doug Laycock said in response was his religious beliefs allow him, this accommodation. But the fact that there's a justice openly talking about dismissing the case, to me, was very, very interesting. And I wonder if that might happen after the next conference or two.
Again, if you have a question for our expert, Jordan Lawrence, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. While we're waiting, Jordan, I wonder if you want to say more about what some of the other justices, how they participated. Did any of the advocates seem to outshine any of the others, or did any of the justices display a skepticism of the arguments being put forth by one side or the other? Were there hard questions directed to one advocate and, over another?
I guess this
is a long way of asking you for a prediction beyond the dig. Do you have a hunch as to which way the court might go?
If they get to the merits on this, I'm just reviewing. I felt that the common thing that was being I felt there were a lot of justices that were asking questions, but it seemed to lack energy. I've been in much. I've watched very oral arguments that are much more energetic than this one. But what seemed to be the what I felt was kind of being said, kind of, you know, beyond the actual words they were saying was, we think that there's a legitimate argument about deferring to the security concerns of the state officials, but we've got this federal statute that basically seems to weigh things pretty heavily in favor of the prisoners, but not totally, because the government can assert a compelling state interest with all of this. So, well, we're going to have to kind of take this statute and apply it, and I guess if it's not right, Congress can fix it. But I think that they're not going to say They're not going to go with full gusto in the prisoner's favor, but they're also not going to, you know, basically nullify the statute by saying this is kind of a dumb public policy of granting compelling state interest protection to people in a high security environment. They're not going to like do that, I think, and say this was, you know, we think this is kind of a dumb public policy thing. It is a federal statute, and I think they could have a 9-0 ruling in favor of the prisoner with a bunch of concurring opinions, you know, kind of trying to walk back a bit from total support for the prisoner in these kinds of situations. But that's the struggle, is how much deference do you give when you have the security issue? Because it can't be that the state could say, no religious expression whatsoever. We think there's a security concern. That could not be the right answer. So how much then do you limit the discretion of the government officials to enforce to specific measures to enforce security? And I'm not sure how far they're going to go. And that seemed to be where the real debate was today in the oral arguments.
All right, we've got another question from our audience. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Betsy Dormany down in Georgia, and thank you very much for very interesting commentary. I'm wondering if the employment angle or any sort of a comparison to federal employment law came up in this discussion at all, because we've run round and round these issues in the employment setting, and of course it's a little bit different from prison because you don't exactly choose to go to prison in most cases, but the workplace seems to have come to terms more or less with reasonable accommodation for religious requirements, and I guess the Supreme Court has already granted cert on a headscarf case that's coming down the pike. But I wonder if that provides any kind of a middle ground, because that, you know, they have allowed beards for religious purposes or for religious reasons when generally the dress code for like a delivery service or something else would prohibit them, and they found a sort of a tolerance in the employment setting that it doesn't sound like they discussed here in this case.
I think that that's an excellent question. And in the Title VII context, and you're talking about the Abercrombie and Fitch case that they granted review on last week about the woman who was denied employment at Abercrombie and Fitch because she wanted to wear a hijab. And I just think it's funny that Abercrombie and Fitch got sued because for people not allowing people to wear more clothing, that you walk in the malls by their, you know, their beefcake pictures there. And I just found that humorous. But that just as an aside. I would say that the big difference, there is a different legal standard in Title VII than to RLUIPA. And even though you can have government employers, it also applies to private employers. You also don't have the security concerns in private employment, and then the fact that they're only there for part of the day. So they go home and, you know, you could worship, you know, during your off hours and that sort of thing. And the security thing just really exerts a gravitational pull on this whole area of law. But then the problem is that it doesn't mean that the government always wins. Whatever security concern that it has always prevails of these whole things. But then you also have, as Professor Otis from Georgetown brought up, the prisoners, I would just say, you have just a higher level of insincere beliefs being asserted, exotic religions that, I mean, many of them I've never even heard of, you know, some Viking religion, and, you know, we have to have swords, you know, in the prison. And, you know, you just, there, it's just like everything that you see in regular religious liberty law, just sort of like, you know, put on steroids and elevated 100-fold in really extreme directions. And, I just find that these cases make it more difficult for regular religious liberty law to win because they're so extreme in a lot of ways. But then also, I don't think it means that the government should always win just because, hey, these prisoners are insincere and the government's got some interest. they do have to sort out the genuine from the fake, and are the government concerns really significant or not in these various cases, in the specific cases that come before them. But then when you get like 10 million of them, there just seem to be lots and lots and lots of these prisoner cases. It makes it even more difficult. It brings sort of a hyperinflation, in a sense, to the whole area of religious liberty law.
Well, that's that. I recall that from the 80s, it seems to me. There was a whole spate of these cases, and it seemed to me that there was some law that went down about that at the time, because people were asserting that they needed, like, T-Bone Steak and Playboy magazine to carry out their religion, and people were a little skeptical of that. The security angle, though, is interesting from the employment perspective, too, and I just offered this, that the EEOC has brought hijab cases on behalf of prison guards, female prison guards, and they've lost, and the EEOC, I think, has lost most of the hijab cases that they have brought. I'm not really aware of them bringing too many Christian-related cases, but certainly in those cases, because they said, you know, precisely the security concerns that you mentioned there of people being able to bring in contraband and being subject to, you know, having the scarf grabbed and used as a weapon to throttle them or something like that. So they, you know, they have drawn the line on the religious headgear for security purposes among the prison guard population, if not perhaps as much under the prison population. But I'm also with Justice Scalia on this, and that seeing the difference between the quarter inch and the half inches is kind of peculiar in a number of ways.
Yeah, I was thinking that Doug Laycock should have grown a beard for this oral argument, so he could have been like a living, you know, model or something like that for the justices, but he didn't do that. He was very clean-shaven today.
Oh, well. Interesting case, I'm sure.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Let me make another call for questions here. If you have a question, the lines are open. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. And let me ask a question, just see if we get a final question from the audience. Was there sympathy? I mean, I have some sympathy for the states here, and this might be a question better directed to the gentleman who dialed in from Alabama, that there are thousands and thousands of these cases filed by prisoners, and the great majority, the vast majority are dismissed out of hand, I take it, but some work their way through the system. Is it unfair to the states? I mean, at what point do the states know they have to start to develop a solid record for a particular case? Given those numbers, are they at a disadvantage here? And does that work a disservice on the court if there's not a completely developed record below?
Andrew Brasher, are you still there? He's the SG of Alabama.
There's somebody lining up the line. Let's see if this is him. Is that Andrew Brasher?
Yeah, this is me again.
I don't know if you were paying attention to the question.
Well, you know, as I was crying over the pile of frivolous prison lawsuits I have to deal with, I did hear some mention of that. I do think that has to be a concern, only because, and I guess the other kind of issue that has to be in the background is that, you know, prisons are very different from the real world in the sense that every thing that every prisoner does has some policy that applies to it. So whereas you and I, we can do most of our lives are covered by no government policy at all, in prison it's the opposite. So if you really open up to this kind of to a real strict scrutiny test, I guess, without substantial deference, you know, I think not only are you allowing a lot of frivolous litigation, but you're allowing frivolous litigation about essentially everything that every kind of policy that a prison has, which addresses every aspect of a prisoner's life. So, you know, I don't know whether that really came out during the argument. I kind of suspect it didn't.
So Andrew, would you say, with your experience in the state of Alabama, is this something, you know, that the sheer volume of cases like this is a I don't know, problem or a challenge or something like that to the AG's office there, and then,
well,
the question, like, when do you kind of sense, like, wait, this is a real one this is, you know, this is just some you know, pretextual kind of case that we can treat as more frivolous.
Yeah. Well, I guess I would say I think the volume of prison litigation, not necessarily religious liberty litigation, but prison litigation, is very substantial and a real problem. Like I say, I mean, especially I think in areas of medical care, for example, you know, basically any time a prisoner is injured in any kind of way, even just because of natural causes, they sue the prison in federal court alleging some kind of constitutional violation. I wouldn't say that religious liberty issues are that similar, only because I think most states do a pretty good job of accommodating most sort of normal religious kind of exercise that that you would see out in civil society. It's really at the margins that you know, like you were talking about these kinds of prison-only religions, basically, where folks are, you kind of think that they're not really in it for the right reasons, where I think you see a problem. You know, we've got our own long-running litigation in Alabama that's been litigated for about 20-some-odd years about hair length policies, but they're not from Muslim inmates. It's Native American, practitioners of Native American religions. And one thing I think that's also interesting about sort of this prison litigation that makes it different from normal litigation is that when you've got prisoners who are going to be spending the rest of their lives in prison, it doesn't mean that you win a case and the case goes away. You win a case and they just file the next case. So, you know, there's one prisoner in Alabama's prison that's been trying to grow his hair long for about 25 years now. And so that case is just, you know, passed down from one person to the next person to the next person. Every time the state wins, he just files another case. So anyway, I feel like I'm just complaining at this point.
No, but this gives a perspective. And I would say the case today, this is in, so here you're getting the, and this might give some more context to what Justice Scalia's suggestion about digging dismiss as improvidently granted, is that there were comments that were made about how, not that this was an easy case, but that seemed to be because the Beard regulation, there's at least, although now it seems to be disputed, whether the Arkansas prisons were allowing the prisoners to grow beards when they had this medical condition, mainly among African American men, where they get these ingrown hairs if they are clean shaven. And so they let their beards grow out a bit, and it keeps their pores from getting, and the hairs getting ingrown and all that sort of stuff. And because they were saying, well, you got a medical condition that overrides our concerns for contraband smuggling and appearance altering, then the court's reaction is, well, what's the big deal here? So in essence, this is kind of the easier case, but what they were realizing was that there's all these kind of cases that are out, that are beyond that, like hair length cases, where they were saying it's much easier to smuggle contraband in long hair. You know, you can pile it on top of your head or whatever, that's different than a beard. And so if they rule in favor of the beards, what about length of hair restrictions, that type of thing? That came up a lot, you know, and I think that it shows somewhat of the reluctance of the Supreme Court to announce a rule in this case, which seems relatively easy, that reverberates to these other ones that seem to be a lot more difficult. And I think that that was the sort of slippery slope. That's the pejorative way of putting it. But what are the ramifications of the rule that's here that we're going to, you know, launch 10,000 more lawsuits if we rule without some lines of definition here with all with what rule we set forth? But then they also have, we have a statute that sort of sets out the parameters, and if we just give full force to it, do we do that? And if there's chaos or a lot of lawsuits, then we let Congress clean up the mess by rewriting the statute.
Well, that almost sounds like a closing remark there, but we are out of questions. Let me revert back to you, Jordan Lawrence, to see if you do want to wrap up here before we adjourn the call.
The only other thing that I would say, this is just is sort of a preview of the with other religious liberty cases. There was the mention of the Abercrombie and Fitch hijab case, which I think would probably be argued early next year sometime, and then also this town of Gilbert, Arizona case where they restricted. They allow temporary signs for political events to be large and out for a long time, but restrict churches that put out signs announcing for their when their church is going to meet. That's going to be argued in January. In fact, it's a case from my organization, Alliance of Any Freedom. Those are the two next biggie, there's not even smally ones. Those are the next two religious liberty cases that the Supreme Court has already agreed to hear this term.
Very good. Well, we'll keep an eye out for those and hope to have you back maybe to cover those cases as well. I do want to thank you, Jordan Lawrence, on behalf of the Federalist Society. We certainly appreciate your insights and your remarks today. Also want to thank the audience for their participation and for joining us today. A reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference call is tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Time, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. But until that next telephone conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.